look at John chapter 4 this morning. Before I do that, I heard a story recently. I love sharing it, so I'm going to share it. It's a story of, the story takes place about 15 miles east of Manistee, Michigan. You guys are familiar with Manistee, right? Okay, so just outside of Manistee, Michigan, it's a story of a teacher, an older teacher named Donald Crouch, and a boy in his English classroom, a 14-year-old boy by the name of Jim. So Donald Crouch, the teacher, and a 14-year-old by the name of Jim in this story, I'm telling you. So the story goes that Jim started in Donald's class, and as the school year kind of progressed, one of the things Donald, Mr. Crouch, understood and started to see was that Jim wasn't engaging. In fact, what he noticed was Jim wasn't talking at all. He was just kind of locked in a cocoon of his own silence and didn't say any words, didn't talk to anyone. At first, he thought that maybe he was just disinterested or problematic, or maybe even just a bit slow and behind. But what he began to realize as he taught was that every time he would bring up the subject of poetry, Jim's eyes would light up. And he saw that there was something there. There was some interest there. And so like many teachers, good teachers often are working far too many hours for far too little pay. And this teacher, like a lot of you, decides, even given his circumstances, he's going to go out of his way to befriend this 14-year-old boy, figure out what's going on in this kid's life that would keep him from engaging and talking in this classroom. So he, after class one day, invites Jim to stay back and have a conversation with him. And as they have this conversation, he starts asking some questions. Mr. Crouch asks questions to Jim, and Jim doesn't answer. He'll ask another question. Jim doesn't say anything. Another question. Nothing. This goes on for an uncomfortably awkward, silent 5, 10, 15 minutes. He asking questions. Jim saying nothing. Finally, he, for whatever reason, Jim actually did respond to one of his questions. And immediately, Mr. Crouch says later, immediately he understood why Jim didn't talk in class. Jim stuttered, and not a little bit, a lot bit. Jim, as he was sharing some of his story and trying to talk about the humiliation he feels and how he would get so picked on for his stutter, and as he's telling this to Mr. Crouch, he's, you know, sputtering and stammering, just trying to get the words out, and he just said at some point, I just stopped talking because I was so sick of getting picked on, because he stuttered so strongly. But as the conversation continued, Mr. Crouch talked about English in the class he teaches, and eventually they brought up the subject of poetry, and again, Jim's eyes lit up. In fact, he recited back to Mr. Crouch one of his favorite lines from one of his favorite poems, and as he recited it, Donald Crouch noticed something in this boy. When he recited poetry, he didn't stutter. So Donald Crouch came up with an idea. Next day in class, he says to his students, I want you to go home tonight. You have some homework. Your homework is to do your assignment is to write a poem. You can pick whatever subject you want to pick. Your job is to write a poem about something that you're passionate about and bring it back to class tomorrow. So Jim goes home, and as he kind of walks in his house in Manistee, Michigan, in the middle of winter, he discovers that a welfare agent has beat him there and has brought the family some large grapefruit. This was not, so I'll give you the date of the story. This is happening kind of right during the Depression era. And at that time, vitamin C was really low, especially in cold parts like Michigan in the winters. And so one of the programs set by the government was, we're going to make sure that to prevent scurvy, which, by the way, first service, I just posted this picture on Facebook, and Mary Beth Pohl was like, oh yeah, that has to do with scurvy. I have no idea how she knows, but it was, she's brilliant. But it was to prevent scurvy, so they had sent it over, and as Jim sees the grapefruit, he says it was the most delectable, delicious thing he's ever experienced in his life. So he goes home, and he writes his poem, and he calls it Ode to a Grapefruit. And then he brings it back to class the next day, and the assignments are collected by Donald Crouch, the teacher. And a couple days later, Donald Crouch comes back with the assignments, back with the poems. And this is, by the way, the part of the story that I don't even know if teachers could get away with this anymore. But this is what he does. He stands in front of his class and he says, thank you for doing the assignment. Many of you, most of you, did phenomenal. Your stuff was great. Some of you were outstanding. One of you was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever read It was unbelievable. Jim, would you stand up and recite your poem for the class? Now, Jim hasn't talked in class. So Jim puts his head down and immediately he goes like, what is happening? Humiliation and fear and all the emotions he's feeling. And in fact, he feels more than anything, he feels betrayed. How dare his teacher kind of like put him in this really uncomfortably awkward spot where now he's going to humiliate himself in front of all of his classmates. But then, very quickly, the humiliation and the fear gives way to another emotion, because this is what Mr. Crouch said next. So first he says, Jim, get up and recite your poem. Then he says, your poem was excellent. In fact, I don't think you wrote it. I think you plagiarized it. If you won't get up and read your poem, you will get an F. Again, this is why I say I don't know that teachers could get away with this. But he knew he needed the push. So now Jim is a little bit angry, and so fear and humiliation have given way to anger, and he stands up in front of the class, he takes his ode to a grapefruit, and he begins reciting it. And it was in that moment that Jim understood something that he didn't see before. When he recited, he didn't stutter. In fact, the classmates heard his voice for the very first time, many of them, and what a voice it was. Big and booming and as clear as a bell. He didn't stutter. So from that point, he decided he's going to memorize more poetry. That gave way to joining the debate class and then the debate team, then the theater. That would give way to signing up and auditioning for Broadway. And that would give way towards Hollywood. And this voice that I'm speaking of, many of you know it. In fact, I would argue most of you know it. Because this voice would become the voice of a generation. Actually, more than a generation, his voice would be the voice of a galaxy. A galaxy far, far away. His would be the voice of Mufasa. His would be the voice of "If you build it, they will come." His will be the voice of, a couple years ago, I was at a University of Michigan game, and at the University of Michigan game, they showed a commercial, and in that commercial for U of M, the voice was the voice of Jim, who grew up to become James Earl Jones. Because one teacher decided, you know what, I see something in this kid that nobody else sees, and decides to invest in this one student, this student goes on to become a voice we think of often, we hear often. Now that's an incredible story, isn't it? Incredible story. First time, like I said, I love telling it. But this story, while it may be fresher to us, isn't even close to as powerful as the story we've been looking at for the last 3 weeks. Because while James Earl Jones has become the voice of a generation and has been the voice behind the scenes in so many of our memories as kids or as adults, the story of the Samaritan woman at the well, that story has changed history. In fact, I would argue that you can draw a direct line from that story to you and I sitting here today. And so, for the last week, I'm kind of sad about it, actually. For the last week, I got so many things I want to share with this story, but for the last week, we're going to go back to the story out of John chapter 4, the story of the Samaritan lady at the well. Unfortunately, I do not have time to walk through where we've been over the last several weeks, but all that information, all the audio and all that stuff is online. I have a couple things to show you. In particular, today, I want to talk about one line. Because we tried to answer lots of questions, but I left one question kind of hanging. And in some ways, when you see this, if you're like me, this shakes some things loose. So there's one line in the story. Instead of reading the whole story again, we've read that 3 times in a row now. I'm just going to read you a couple lines before this one line, and then a couple lines after this one line, just so you have your bearing in the story. Really? All right. All right. Verse 19. So John 4, verse 19. Sir, the woman said to Jesus, I can see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. Now, just a little bit of context, I guess. Last week we talked about the 750-year-old rivalry between the Jews and the Samaritans. So this is what she's referencing. Verse 21. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we know. And then this line, for salvation is from the Jews. Now, that, when I first read it, and still many times after, bothered me. Because it has an exclusive nature to it, does it not? Salvation is from the Jews. Talking to a Samaritan woman, it's kind of insulting, it feels. It has a sense of, this is about our people, our tribe, our race. And you read something like this and you think, this feels so un-Jesus-like. And then notice what he says next, just to make it more confusing. He says, yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is Spirit, and his worshipers must worship in Spirit and in truth. So in one breath, he says, salvation is from the Jews. And then the next breath, he says, but a time is coming and is in fact now upon you where it's not just about one ethnicity or one mountain or one group of people. This message is for every person. Salvation is from the Jews. Now, what do we do with a line like that? A couple thoughts, a couple observations. First, you have to pay attention to what Jesus says and what Jesus doesn't say in the passage. So notice that Jesus says that salvation is from the Jews. Jesus doesn't say that salvation is for the Jews. That one word is pretty critical. Salvation is from the Jews is different than salvation is for the Jews. For replies like I'm receiving something. It's for me and it's not for you. From means I'm giving something. I have something for you. From means that I am being used to give you a gift of some sort. For, like, I'm getting something. So salvation is from the Jews, not for the Jews. So the question, though, is why would Jesus say this line to this woman in this moment? It seems like a wrong moment. Why would he say this line to this woman in this moment? Now, in order to understand that, you have to back the story up just a bit. So the story begins, John chapter 4 begins in verse 1, right? Okay. So the story begins in verse 1. We've read it the last couple of weeks. Verse 1 of this story talks about how Jesus is on the run. He's essentially being hunted. And the people that are hunting him, that they want to kill him, are a group of Jewish religious leaders known as the Pharisees. Now that raises a question. Why do the Pharisees want to kill Jesus? Why is he running? We're in chapter 4. Like, there's not a lot of story before this. Why is he running already? In order to understand that, you have to back up a little bit to John chapter 2. John chapter 2, Jesus is in Jerusalem, now the place he's running from. And he's in Jerusalem. First service. I think I just stepped wrong and they all went... Totally killed it. All right. The reason he's in Jerusalem is because he's traveling there for the Passover celebration. It's the biggest cultural holiday to the Jewish people. At the Passover celebration, he heads into the temple. Again, the temple comes up in the John 4 story too, so it's a big deal. He heads to the temple, and when he heads to the temple, he sees that there's something going on in the temple, and it really ticks him off. Some of you know the story. He goes to the temple and they're exchanging money for animals. And he is livid. Let me read you what he does. He made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. Jesus is livid, and in a moment of extreme anger, Jesus flips over tables, is driving out animals. I mean, it's a crazy story. Raises a question. Why is Jesus so angry? Now, in order to understand the answer to that question, you have to go to architecture. Let me show you an image. This is not a picture, but a recreation. This is the temple of Jerusalem. Again, the temple was destroyed years later by the Romans, but this is a recreation, a model of sorts. And the way the temple was designed, as laid out by God in the Old Testament, was in a series of rooms. So some rooms were covered, some rooms were open courtyards, but there was a series of rooms. The image in the center, you see it? The big thing in the center was what was known as the Holy of Holies. It was a room designed and devoted only for one person to enter once a year on the Day of Atonement. Only the high priest could enter that, a Jewish priest. Now, right outside of that room, there is another courtyard, another room. That room is known as the priestly courtyard. Jewish priests were allowed in that room. Outside of that, you have a room for Jewish men. Outside of that, you have a room that Jewish women could enter into. And then outside of that, in the big section of the courtyard, by far the majority of the temple is what is known as the Gentile court, or the court of Gentiles. This was an area set aside not for Jewish people, but for every person. You following? Raises a question. Why would God, when he's designing a temple for the Jewish people, why would he want them to design it in such a way that the bulk of the temple was left for people who weren't Jewish? It's a question, right? Now, in order to understand that and the answer to that, you have to go back a little bit, all the way to the beginning of the Bible, in fact. The very first Jew, for all intents and purposes, was a guy by the name of Abraham, who has many sons of father. Yeah, okay. Abraham. God comes to Abraham and he says to Abraham, I want to make you my nation. You're going to become the Jewish people. You're going to have a son. He's going to have a son. He's going to have a son. He's going to have a son. And that people is going to become a nation. We refer to them as the Jewish nation. Now he gives them this promise. He gives Abraham this promise. He says to Abraham, I'm going to bless you. But he also adds something to this. It's not just I'm going to bless you because I love you. That's true. But he says, I'm going to bless you so that. Let me read you that. Genesis 12. He says, I'm going to bless you so that all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So the nature of the thing is God is setting aside a person who will become a people so that they can become a conduit for God's love and grace and salvation to every person. Why is Jesus angry? Why is Jesus upset? Why is Jesus on the run? Jesus is on the run because he stormed the temple. Jesus storms the temple because the Jewish people had forgotten that their mission in the world was to be a conduit of God's love, and instead set up in the very spot on the temple that was designed for the world, like a profiteering scheme for themselves. And Jesus is livid. And so you have this moment where Jesus meets this woman at a well, and he sees this woman. And he says to this woman, I'm essentially going to do what the Jewish people were supposed to do. Salvation is always supposed to be from the Jews, not for the Jews, from the Jews. So I, God in the flesh, am going to do what God in the flesh has always wanted, what God has always wanted his people to do. I'm going to go to you, and I'm going to love you, and I'm going to care for you. Here's what Jesus understands. Jesus understands that the way you save the world is by first looking for and finding for the one person you can save. The way you save the world is first by saving the one. Let me say that again. The way you save the world is by first finding, locating, and saving the one. Now, let me show you what happens next in the story. Jesus meets this woman, and then he sends her back into her village. And it says this. This is Paul Harvey would say, this is the rest of the story. We've ended before this every week. Verse 39. Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did. So when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with them, and he stayed 2 days. And because of his words, many more became believers. They said to the woman, we no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is, and I quote, the Savior of the world. You see how it works? Jesus saves the world by saving the one. He saves the world by saving the one. Jesus goes to one Samaritan woman. She then goes to her neighbors, who then go to their neighbors, who then go to their neighbors, who then come back to Jesus. And soon, the whole world, they're saying, you're the Savior of the whole world. Jesus saves the world by saving the one. The story starts with a lady, and she's lonely, and she's at a well. Jesus starts with her. By the way, this is the very first time in the book of John that Jesus approaches somebody who's not Jewish. Why are you and I gathered here? Because Jesus saves the world by starting with the one. You with me? In 2009, in, I do not know how to pronounce Dutch things, but in a city called Leeuwarden. Leeuwarden. How do you pronounce that? What he said. All right. Leeuwarden. In Leeuwarden, the Netherlands. I can say that. In the Netherlands, in 2009, in November, a company known as the Weicher Production Company decided that they were going to try to set a world record. Their world record was to set up the biggest domino fall ever, in recorded history at least. The biggest domino fall. So they got some very OCD people to line up. Get this, 4.5 million dominoes. 4.5 million dominoes. Now, they had a secondary theory behind this whole thing. They said 4.5 million dominoes. Their guess was that one little tip of one little domino could unleash a tremendous amount of energy. They wanted to prove it. And so one domino fell, and then the whole chain began to fall. 4.5 million, letting off what they discovered later, because they monitored and measured, 94,000 joules of energy. Now, I don't know what a joule of energy is, but here's what I read. 94,000 joules of energy is about the amount of energy it takes for a grown man to do 545 push-ups. A lot of energy. Not for some of you, but for most of you. Yeah, lots of energy. And so they discovered that one, the way you impact lots of things is by strategically structuring things to fall in a specific order, and a very little amount of energy can produce a tremendous amount of energy. Now, this is a theory known as the domino effect. You've heard of the domino effect. The domino effect comes out of the American Journal of Physics 1983 article by a guy by the name of Lorne Whitehead. Lorne Whitehead, in the American Journal of Physics, coined the phrase domino effect. And in that publication, he talks about how not only can a little domino produce a tremendous amount of energy by hitting other little dominoes, but one domino can take over and take down a domino that is 50% larger than it. So a 2-inch domino can take down a 4-inch domino, which can take down an 8-inch domino. You understand? That was in 83. Then 2001, someone tested the theory. They caught 8 dominoes. This person was out of the San Francisco, some physicist out of San Francisco. I can't remember where, but some physicist out of San Francisco decided to test it. He got 8 cardboard slabs, kind of created the domino effect with them. And the first one was 2 inches, and then he had them kind of slowly go up. The 8th one was a little less than 3 feet tall. The first one fell with a click. The second one with a bit louder click. The 8th one fell with a boom. This got some people thinking. I wonder how far we could take this. Now, this theory is still, like, there are people that are looking to take, like, challenge this theory and see how far can we take it. Here's the projections. If gravity plays true in this, and if physics plays true in this, by the 10th domino, you could take down with a 2-inch domino, a domino the size of me, by the 10th domino. By the 18th domino, you could take down a building the size of the Leaning Tower of Pisa? I never know how to say that. I was going to say pizza, but I'm just hungry. Leaning Tower of Pisa. Then by the 23rd, you could take down a building the size of the Eiffel Tower. By the 31st, you, if you could somehow design this, could take down a domino, something as large as 3 feet taller than Mount Everest. Now, if gravity held all the way to the moon, by the time you got to the 57th domino, you would have a domino the size from Earth to the moon, and if the theory holds true, a 2-inch domino could be set in motion and could take down all the other dominoes. All the other dominoes. The domino effect. Now, what they discovered was one small domino has a tremendous ability to go far. Jesus, by the way, says that the way we are to be in the world is to understand that the way you save the world is by saving the one. Here's my question. What does your one little domino have the potential to do? See if it worked. What does your one little domino have the potential to do?
It worked.
First service, not so much.
What is it? What does your one domino have the potential to do? The way Jesus saves the world is by saving the one. Jesus reaches the Samaritan woman who reaches her neighbors, who reaches her neighbors, who ends up, you and I, you can draw a direct line between them and us. She is the first Gentile person that was reached. Unless you're Jewish by ethnicity, you can draw a direct line to them. Jesus saves the world by saving the one. See, here's what I think often happens. I call this paralysis of the impossible. You and I look at the problems of our world, and we look at our ability to solve those problems, and it's like a 2-inch domino. And the problems of our world feel like moon-sized problems, right? I think the statistic is still true that 30,000 children right now in Africa are dying every single day of starvation, malnutrition. Just think about that number. It was 2016, a report came out that there are 6,000 unreached people groups, which means that there are 6,000 people groups in the age of the internet, in the age of social media. There are 6,000 people groups on our planet that still predominantly do not know about Jesus. Less than 2% of them know about Jesus. And so we hear these statistics and we look at our one little domino, our one little life, and we say, I can't do anything about that. So you hear the Sarah McLachlan song and you decide to change the channel because what is my thing going to do about that thing? That problem's way too big for me to even make a dent in. And in fact, I have my own problems. If you're like me, I have a house in the suburbs and I'm just trying to make the payments on that thing. And I've got a car and the car always seems to break and cost money. And you have a job and you're just trying to like, make the money to cover the bills, and you've got your own problems, and you have this domino, and we forget. In fact, I would actually say that anytime the church has ever forgotten, that the way we change the world is by saving the one, we have lost our ability to make influence in this world. Anytime we think that, oh, the way we change the world is by electing the right person, that's important, but that's not the way you change the world. The way you change the world is by saving the one. Anytime the church has forgotten that, we have lost our influence in the world. So you hear the stories. I actually think God wired us with this. You hear the stories of guys like, James Earl Jones. You hear the stories of guys like James Earl Jones, and something sparks alive in us. Why does it spark alive? I think it's because deep within us, we all know this is true. Right? All of us probably can name a person who has significantly impacted our life. If you're very, very fortunate, you can maybe name 2 or 3 people, and they loved you and they cared for you and no one else did, and your life is different. Here's the thing. If Donald Crouch, a teacher, an English teacher who is getting older in years, if he can change one person's life, which became the voice of a galaxy, through the sheer force of love, which is a gift of God, which is of God, what happens when we take our 1-inch domino and we, not just through love, yes, but also through the power of the Holy Spirit, because we line up with his mission in the world. What's possible? I've been thinking a lot about this. What is possible for one human life? Jesus teaches us that Jesus saves the world. The way you save the world is by first starting with the one. Start with the one. Start with the one. Don't fall for the lie of the impossible. Start with the one. What's possible? I want to introduce you to my newest, I described him last time as my newest best friend, because I just have talked to him for a few minutes and I'm just so wowed by his story. But we're today celebrating Compassion Sunday, and Jay Biro. Yeah. Jay Biro is, got a tremendous story. Compassion International partners churches with, I'll let him share his story. If you could please welcome to our stage, Jay Biro.